Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin at the Wake Up Call on this 29th day of June 2012. Well, I thought I'd bring you yet another example of the hype and lies created by so-called interested market observers with an axe to grind. And this is all in the purpose of giving you some kind of a guide when it comes to listening to people on the radio, or watching them on TV, or reading them in the press, and trying to find out what is real and what is, in fact, just basic hype. Well, I have to tell you, this time it coincides with yet another mouthful of nonsense emitted by someone who should know better. Stuart Miller, CEO of Lennar, the home builder. And by the way, first of all, let me quote a very apt comment from Bill King of the King Report as follows. The big banks have become hedge funds, but are backed by the Fed and taxpayer funds. You think that provides them with a competitive advantage? The Fed encourages and abets big banks to trade like hedge funds so the banks can generate even craft earnings to keep them afloat. If you woke up this morning and read some of the headlines that pertain to the housing market, you might be convinced that the bottom is in and that the next bull market in housing is starting. Of course, it's funny how home builder, realtor, and government numbers diverge from one of the best grassroots statistics, i.e. mortgage purchase applications. Mortgage purchase applications declined again last week, and I quote, the unadjusted purchase index decreased more than 2% compared with the previous week and was almost 3% lower than the same week 1 year ago, end of quote. Well, how can housing possibly be going through a recovery when purchase applications have been mostly lower week to week during the peak home selling season? It makes no sense. Either the mortgage bankers are lying, or the home builders, realtors, and government are all lying. I know which constituent I would bet is lying. I will say that there has been a lot of strength in the low price end of the market. But this is coming from investors who are taking advantage of government financing programs to buy low-end homes and turn them into rentals. As I have shown in previous calls, Fannie and Freddie announced this program several months ago. Ironically, they needed an outlet for all the homes they repossessed to make room for more foreclosures. Wash, rinse, repeat. Well, someone I know put in an offer on a lower-end price townhome last week in an area of Denver that had bubbled up during the housing bubble, and she was topped by an investor who paid the full asking price. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I can assure you this will not last, and real buyers would be well advised not to chase it. The other source of housing market euphoria was on Wednesday with the earnings report from Lennar. The headline proclaimed a huge increase in earnings for the quarter, and the CEO announced that the housing market was in recovery. Of course, what was not in the headlines was the fact that Lennar used a complicated accounting maneuver to generate most of its earnings. of the $453 million in reported GAAP earnings, $403 million was generated by a non-cash, quote, reversal of the deferred tax asset valuation allowance, end of quote. That's essentially a deferred tax asset which occurs when a company pays the tax man more in actual cash taxes than it reports in GAAP income for reporting to shareholder purposes. There's two sets of books, you see, the GAAP book and the cash book, or the book of numbers used to calculate actual tax payments to the government. There are so-called timing devices for recognizing income between the two sets of books. And depending on the circumstances in any given year, a company may pay a lot more or a lot less than the government in taxes than it reports to investors in financial statements. It's a great earnings management tool for management. Depending on the situation, that creates a deferred tax asset or liability. It has the effect of either reducing or increasing GAAP income versus tax income. When this happens, a balance sheet account is set up called a deferred tax asset or liability, and over time, this asset is amortized into net income to recapture income that occurred but not recognized for GAAP reporting purposes. In Lennar's specific situation, the deferred tax asset resulted from declining revenues. It's actually too complicated to go into here. But Lennar decided that the housing market is going to get better for the foreseeable future, and it was allowed to recognize most of its deferred tax asset this quarter by, quote, revaluing a lot lower, by $403 million to be precise, its deferred tax asset. It has no real cash or economic impact on the company other than to juice the stock in the short term. It's complete accounting chicanery, and it's an accounting standard that needs to be reformed. It also enables Lennar CEO Stuart Miller to earn a big bonus, assuming part of his compensation is based on earnings. Having said that, you can understand why Miller is so bullish on the housing market. He has to be, because it's the only way he can justify using the accounting gimmick he used to generate 88% of Lennar's reported income. I remember Stuart Miller and Lennar from my days dealing in bonds and junk bonds. We did a complicated junk bond financing at Morgan Stanley for Lennar's financing arm. Lennar is a byproduct of the Drexel Burden accounting fraud days, and Stuart Miller has never seen an accounting gimmick that he didn't lovingly embrace. In fact, Miller has been a very steady seller of Lennar stock over the past decade. If he's so bullish on housing, shouldn't he be loading up investments account with Lennar stock? But you see, the point here, and again, ladies and gentlemen, this is where I come in with the usual warnings and exhortations to wake up and smell the roses. You really have to look under the hood these days in order to differentiate from headline reporting fraud, hype, and the truth. More importantly, you really have to know where to look. Now, I had to depend on someone brushing up on the accounting for deferred tax assets from their accounting 101 days in order to make sense of Lennar's earnings report, understand why it's fraudulent, and understand why Miller was so ebullient on the prospects for the housing market. After untangling that GAAP accounting mess in conjunction with the mortgage purchase index indicator, as well as all the factors I have described to you in recent shows, and also in conjunction with what this person knows and has written about the escalating foreclosure dynamic, I have concluded that the real organic housing market is still going a lot lower. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, a little bit complicated, but what on earth can I say? I don't see any other way to bring this to you other than to really bring you through the hoops on this one. But obviously, the everyday man in the street is at an absolute loss. I mean, you don't even begin to unravel all that stuff on your own, and that is what is so very unfair and so very sad, thinking, you know, investors are being led up the garden path by this kind of thing. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, let me give you my information. Richard Martin is the name, and the wake-up call is the show, and it's coming to you from sunny Singapore. Well, if I look out of the window here, it's a pitch dark because it's the dead of night here, isn't it? But trust me, it is sunny enough. And as always, if you want to call in and let me hear from you and everybody else too, you may do so through our toll-free number at 888-874-4888. I repeat, the toll-free number to get through to us, offer us your good advice and interesting thoughts. Please call in at 888-874-4888. If you would like to email me, and the email address is always the same, and it's open here in my box, the email address is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin, GFAWD, Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. Once more, rm@gfawd.com. And finally, my own number, my direct line, if you want to talk to me about your issues, whatever they may be, you may do that, because my number is available to you 24 hours a day at the following number in Sarasota, Florida, area code 941-441-1682. That's again my private number. Anybody who feels like calling in to talk, please feel free, call in at 941-441-1682. And please be aware now that the next meetup group will be held in July. I believe I have the date, but I don't have it on me, and Jack was kind enough to send it to me, but I cannot be 100% sure of it, but I believe that it is the 22nd of July. I'm almost sure it's the 22nd of July at 2 p.m. in New Brunswick, New Jersey. That's New Brunswick, which is equidistant between Philly and New York City and is reachable by train. And the George Street Ale House, where the sessions take place, is within a stone's throw of the railroad station, so please feel free to take either a train or drive to plentiful parking on a Sunday afternoon at the George Street Ale House, 378 George Street, New Brunswick, New Jersey. And in the fullness of time, I'm sure Jack will let me know what to expect, but I will tell you that Brian, who is currently in Korea, will be talking about teaching English as a foreign language, and teaching English is something that most of you will be able to take to very, very quickly if you should wish to relocate to a non-English-speaking country, especially in the third world. They are always looking for English teachers. You will find plentiful ads, plentiful opportunity for work, both in language schools and also privately. And Brian will be talking about that on the 22nd of July. So please, ladies and gentlemen, if you are of a mind to go, call Jack in the usual way. His number is 914-414-6940. That's Jack Trevesta, who would like to hear from you. If you have any ideas, if there's anything you want him to talk about or to discuss, please call at 914-414-6940. Okay, so got plenty of time to organize yourselves. Hopefully that will happen, and you will all have a very good time indeed. Well, a Financial Times headline tells us that the quote, U.S. will rule the day it started a cyber war. Here's why. In addition to signing death warrants for people who have never been charged with a crime, much less ever convicted, the Obama administration is now taking credit for starting what industry insiders are calling Cybergeddon. The U.S. feds got together with the Israeli feds to create a computer virus, which apparently completely disables a software system. Then it put it out to work against a country which, with which neither nation is at war. Well, what gives? Is it now okay for groups of hackers to attack whomever they please, when they please? Is internet vandalism now U.S. policy? If so, you could hardly fault a collection of clever Iranians, perhaps with the help of Russians, Iraqis, Chinese, and who knows, for getting together to launch a counterattack, could you? And you wouldn't be surprised to find that they have taken key elements of the U.S. bug, re-engineered it, and sent it right back where it came from, would you? One of the enduring characteristics of superpowers is that they always find some way to destroy themselves. Hitler and Bonaparte could have remained masters of all Europe, perhaps indefinitely. Instead, they found Russia. Japan found Pearl Harbor, and now Barack Obama has found a new area of warfare where America is most vulnerable and where its historic advantages count for almost nothing. As to the first point, here is a question. What would happen to you if your credit card stopped working? The ATMs don't work. You can't buy anything with a credit card. What do you do? Go to the bank? Forget it. Within hours, the banks would be out of cash. You would have no means to buy food. But so what? There wouldn't be any food to buy anyway. America's dependence on computer systems and its vulnerability to disruption was well researched and documented in the run-up to the year 2000. The Y2K problem might have brought the whole country to a dead end. Well, it didn't. And now the economy is more vulnerable than it was then. If the computers stop working, the whole system breaks down. Transportation, shipping, shopping, the whole supply chain that keeps us going stops. What a great idea to encourage innovation and deployment of computer viruses. It's as if a person who lived in a glass house handed out rocks. But it's worse, because the U.S. has huge military advantages. It is able to spend much more money than its rivals. It is able to produce more weapons. It's able to put more firepower into the field and to blow up more buildings and kill more people. But on the Internet, its advantages are minimal. You know, money is important, but it's not nearly as important in computer warfare as it is in conventional warfare. This new battlefield gives America's enemies an advantage. They don't have to spend $700 billion, most of it wasted on zombie bureaucracy and expensive but useless weapons. After all, we are in a late degenerate period. Instead, they can put together a small, talented, focused, and motivated team. And then your credit card will stop working. All right, well, just something for you to think about, ladies and gentlemen. Well, TARP was rammed through the captured Congress by the oligarchs despite a 300-to-1 opposition from the public in order to protect obscenely wealthy bankers, stockholders, and bondholders. The $800 billion of debt-financed political pork disguised as stimulus was doled out to corporate contributors, union thugs, and a myriad of other special interests. Zero interest rates are specifically geared to generate billions of risk-free profits for Wall Street and to force retirees to gamble their dwindling retirement funds in the rigged stock market. Bernanke and Paulson threatened the limp-wristed pocket protector CPAs at the FASB into allowing Wall Street banks to make up the value of their loan portfolios in order to mislead the public regarding their insolvency. the tripling of the Federal Reserve balance sheet from $950 billion in September 2008 to $2.9 trillion today was done to remove the toxic assets from the balance sheets of the too-big-to-fail Wall Street cabal at 100 cents on the dollar. QE1, QE2, and Operation Twist have had the sole purpose of providing the sophisticated financial elite with the funds to pump into the stock market using their high-frequency trading supercomputers. The middle class has a gut feeling that they are being screwed by somebody. They just can't figure out who to blame. The ultra-wealthy elite keep up an endless cacophony of propaganda and misinformation designed to confuse an increasingly uneducated and willfully ignorant public while blurring the facts for those educated few capable of understanding the truth. They have been able to keep the masses dumbed down through government-run education, distracted by sports, reality TV, Facebook, internet porn and eye gadgets, lured by mass media messages of materialism and shackled with the chains of debt used to acquire the goods sold by mega corporations. The destruction of the middle class has been methodical and systematic. The top 10% of earners had a median net worth of $1.19 million, or 192 times as much as the median wealth of $6,200, those in the bottom 20% in 2010. In 2007, the top 10% had 138 times as much wealth as the bottom 20%. In 2001, it was 106 times as much. With the continued rise in the stock market, declining real wages for the middle class, and further home price declines, the gap between the top 10% and the bottom 20% has continued to widen. The level of pain being experienced by the middle class has reached an unprecedented extreme. The money interests have brilliantly pitted the middle class against the lower class through their control of the media, academia, and the political system. They have cleverly blamed the victims for their own plight. They have convinced the general public that millions have lost their homes to foreclosure because they were careless, greedy, and stupid. They blame the Community Reinvestment Act. They blame others for taking on too much debt when they were the issuers of the debt. The Wall Street moneyed interests created the fraud-inducing mortgage products, employed the thousands of sleazy mortgage brokers, bullied appraisers into fraudulent appraisals, paid off rating agencies, bribed the regulators, bet against the derivatives they had sold to their clients, threatened to burn down the financial system unless Congress handed them $700 billion, and paid themselves billions in bonuses for a job well done. But according to these greedy, immoral idiots, the real problem in the United States is the lazy, good-for-nothing parasites on food stamps collecting unemployment who need to stop complaining and pick themselves up by their bootstraps and get a damn job. It's a storyline used against Occupy Wall Street and anyone who questions their right to plunder what is left on the carcass of America. The vilest fraud in the history of man was perpetrated by these evil men, and not one executive of these firms has been prosecuted. Obama, the champion of the little people, has proven to be nothing but a figurehead for the powers that be. Proof that Wall Street Syndicate is winning the war couldn't be any clearer than the fact that the top six criminal banks now have 40% more of the nation's assets in their vaults than they did before they burned down the economy. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, this is for you to digest in your own time and to make of what you will, but frankly, it boggles the mind. Future generations, I dread to think what they will have to say. I don't even know if future generations will bring themselves to believe any of this, whether they will simply revise history in the way that they've always done in the past. But anyway, let us take a break and have our promos, and I will be right back. Well, I think we're back. Let us continue on our merry way. Right. Well, Joseph Stiglitz, by the way, who I've mentioned here several times in the past, recently had some fairly pithy comments to make about America. He points out that U.S. inequality is at its highest point for nearly a century. Those at the top are enjoying a larger share of the national pie. The number below the poverty level is growing. The median income of Americans today is lower than it was a decade and a half ago. And the median income of a full-time male worker is lower than it was more than four decades ago. Meanwhile, those at the top have never had it so good. Financial regulations allow predatory lending and abusive credit card practices that transfer money from the bottom to the top. So do bankruptcy laws that provide priority for derivatives. The rules of globalization, where capital is freely mobile but workers are not, enhance an already large asymmetry of bargaining. Businesses threaten to leave the country unless workers make strong concessions. America used to be thought of as the land of opportunity. Today, a child's life chances are more dependent on the income of his or her parents than in Europe or any other of the advanced industrial countries for which there are data. The U.S. worked hard to create the American dream of opportunity, but today that dream is a myth. That myth is so much part of America's sense of identity that it's devastating for them to have to give it up. For Americans to say they are less of a land of opportunity than old, ossified Europe. It was one of the things that they were most proud of, and clearly it's not true. When you have something that's so inconsistent with your self-image, it's very hard to face the facts. Well, let us take a few emails at this point. Comes one from Alberto, and Alberto has the following to say. Hi, Richard. I am listening in southern Poland in an isolated monastery on the border with the Czech Republic. It's Monday, the 26th of June, 2012. I am Alberto, who formerly worked for Alan Greenspan and also wrote to you a lot about moving to Guadalajara, Mexico, and my own three decades experiences there. I recently heard you talk of Colombia as a place to go, as to a place to retreat to from the horrors awaiting the USA. This must be in error. They come now to Miami and New York for shopping. Everything else there is more costly there than the USA. I have business ties to Colombia and also friends who go back and forth. The dollar is not 3,000 pesos anymore, but more like 1,700 pesos. And they have high inflation. Consequently, Colombia could only be referred to people with a social security approaching 2,000 US dollars, and certainly not the 1,000 US dollars more typical of many for which it would be enough to live well in Guadalajara, Mexico. Costa Rica is out. Colombia is out. Ecuador is a maybe. But a long trip from the USA in case of health or other emergencies. Nicaragua is a maybe, but all of those countries like Nicaragua, Honduras, and Guatemala suffer from very high insecurity issues and lack of policing issues. Honduras and Guatemala are on a de facto currency pegged to the dollar, but they do not correct for their often high inflation. As such, not such good bargains. Mexico, with its current float, like now when the dollar is high there, is a better deal, as you can cash out when the dollar is high and the peso is low. The bulk of countries you recommend are not for low budget or low social security seniors. You need to make that point. Don't present them as affordable when they are not to the average income senior. Well, if they are coming in droves to shop in the USA for many items, then obviously the country is very overpriced. All the best to you, and keep up the otherwise good work, Alberto in Poland. P.S. You may read this on the air. Sincerely, Alberto. Well, Alberto, what can I say? You know, I don't really make recommendations per se other than Sri Lanka. I really recommend Sri Lanka because it's cheap. It's just had a 30-year war. And quite frankly, I believe that it's real good value. And so, frankly, I would definitely recommend it. But other than for that, and of course, Singapore is very expensive. It really depends on the kind of person you are. Obviously, it depends on the kind of money you have as to what country you're going to live in. There are some countries with relatively low cost living standards, like, for example, Malaysia, where I have just got back from about 20 minutes ago, which explains perhaps why I'm not, I haven't had a chance to breathe or drink anything. I just got back actually 1 minute past 10 p.m., which is 1 minute past 10 a.m. your time. And by the way, I may say in passing, this explains why I have not had a chance to prepare for you some information on what has been happening in Europe in the last 24 hours, but I will do so. And be sure that by Monday I will have some information for you, ladies and gentlemen. I hope that answers some of your concerns there, Alberto. I am sorry about Colombia being out. I know Colombia well. I've lived in Venezuela next door, and I've done a lot of business in Colombia. They're very, very nice people, very educated, the kind of people that you can actually have a conversation with. And the cost of living, I understood, was fairly inexpensive, but things may have changed in the last 3 or 4 years. Just a quick word from Matt. Matt, you heard my comment, I just got back. I have been trying to IM you. Not seeming to get anything from you right now. I'm a little concerned because I don't seem to have anything on the AOL IM circuit, although I am up and running here, so perhaps you could just let me know you're with me. Okay, I saw you say hi, that's fine. Good, well then we're all in business. Alex wrote in saying, "Hi Richard, your show seems rather science fiction, like as if to say, if you don't watch out, this is what can happen to us. The thing is, we've had dire warnings for years, and it seems like you said the cliff is in sight. My question is, I live in Toronto, married to an Australian, and we have 2 boys, 2 and 4. We don't have a lot of money saved, but I do have money put away in an RSP and an RESP for our boys' schooling. I also save in a money market account that gets hardly an ounce of interest, but is supposedly safe. I heard a question in your show that you responded that Canada should be okay. As you can imagine, my boys are in my best interest. Do I pull my money out? Do you think moving to a province where the oil is a wise move? What about Australia or New Zealand? Basically, Ontario's manufacturing is becoming non-existent, so I wonder if Toronto's collapse is in sight. My job currently is as an art director for a successful clothing company. My wife is a brilliant cook. Why I mention that is we're a creative couple that have a knack for being leaders in our craft. Any advice for someone like me? You must get bombarded with questions, so I apologize for adding to the pile. Thanks for your show. Alex. Alex, I mention Canada because I think that socially Canada is a much more appropriate country to live in than the United States. As I've said before, my primary gripe with the United States is in what is going to happen to the people as the relatively high standard of living enjoyed by Americans for so long morphs into really a standard of living that I personally believe will become close to, if not redolent of, a third world country. I really believe this is going to happen. I think that that the wealth of the United States has been sucked out. Americans are unfortunately left with the debt, and future generations are going to be left with the debt as well. So I really am despondent about the future in the States. And one of the things that concerns me most is that as America moves down the totem pole into very reduced circumstances, the people of the country are going to have a very hard time accepting this. And I think this is going to lead to violence and social unrest. And that is why I feel that it is incumbent upon people to take measures which don't involve moving to a secluded corner of the country, because there will be none under those circumstances. And as I've always said to you, living in a country in the third world is much more doable, given that people in that part of the world are already poor, so they know how to look after themselves. America is going to have to make an adjustment into that kind of a lifestyle, and it isn't going to be pleasant. And that's why I feel that whatever your financial circumstances, and unless you have a job from which you really can jump ship at a moment's notice, I do think that making plans is not a bad idea, and in fact it's really essential at this point. All right, well, the most recent estimate for the difference between the net present value of federal government liabilities and the net present value of future federal revenues is $200 trillion, ladies and gentlemen. That is nearly 13 times the debt as stated by the U.S. Treasury. Now notice that these figures too are incomplete, since they omit the unfunded liabilities of state and local governments, which are estimated to be around $38 trillion. These mind-boggling numbers represent nothing less than a vast claim by the generation currently retired or about to retire on their children and grandchildren, who are obligated by current law to find the money in the future by submitting either to substantial increases in taxation or to drastic cuts in other forms of public expenditure. To illustrate the magnitude of the problem, the economist Lawrence Kotlikoff calculates that to eliminate the federal government's fiscal gap would require either an immediate 64% increase in all federal taxes or an immediate 40% cut in all federal expenditures. Well, ladies and gentlemen, just an addendum to what I said just now. The transition is going to be brutal. It's going to be very, very painful. It's going to put older people at the mercy of younger people. In other words, as you get older and the younger people take the positions, the reins of power, these younger people are the people that the older people have left their debts to. Do you think you're going to be nicely treated by these younger people? Do you really think they're going to give you a break? I don't think so. And can I blame them? Well, that's a judgment call, isn't it? But it's certainly something that you need to bear in mind when you decide what really is in your interest. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's take an email from Carlos Gutierrez, who writes in saying, "Hello, Richard. Regarding your wake-up call on Friday the 15th of June, would you be so kind as to expand on the notion of what would happen to the U.S. dollars that are in the Greek banks, a Greek collapse pending? That was the first time, a long-time listener, have you heard a talk about this topic? Please, would you elaborate on why the United States, quote, does not look at it kindly, people looking for receptacles where to put their dollars? I mean, why would these monies be considered spoils or swag by the U.S. government? Would you provide us with the quick and dirty fundamentals? Thank you, Carlos Gutierrez. Well, Carlos, basically, there is more paper money outside the United States than in. I don't know whether you knew this, but many, many more people hold money outside the country than inside it. Dollars that are in Greek banks, remember, as I've mentioned before, they are no use to anybody until they return to the United States. Now, this is true of any foreign currency which is being held in any country other than the country of origin of that particular currency. Now, in the case of U.S. dollars held in Greek banks, I can only suggest that those Greek bank dollars must find their way at some point to the United States, and they will do, in no question about it, in my opinion. I don't happen to know who holds those dollars. I'm not privy to that information. I think a lot of those dollars will already have left Greece. I know a lot of the euros have left Greece. There's no particular reason why the dollars should have stayed behind. I think that, as I've said before, what you see in Greece today is what you're looking at in the United States in the future. I think it's a very good guide as to what you can expect in the future, both from a local, internal, domestic viewpoint and also from an international viewpoint. In the end, it comes down to it not really mattering who holds U.S. dollars and really whether the currency is the world's reserve currency or not. If people don't want them, they're going to sell them. And if they sell U.S. dollars, I can only tell you, ladies and gentlemen, the United States is going to be in dire straits. And this could happen very quickly because, to be honest, people holding U.S. dollars are not doing this out of charity to America. They're not lending their money out of charity. They're doing this because, quite frankly, they have no choice. And the only choice they will have will be to sell those dollars into the market. Now, it so happens that the dollar is falling very substantially today, but I think that's much more to do with what's happening in Europe rather than what's happening elsewhere. And unfortunately, as I said, I have just this moment got back from a trip to Malaysia, and so I have not had a chance to study what is actually happening, but I will do so, and I will be in touch as soon as I have managed to sort this one out. Anyway, thank you for your email, Carlos. Chris Fountain in New Haven, Connecticut, wrote in saying, "Hi, Richard. I would like to ask Sarita why she chose Ecuador over the other South American countries, specifically Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia. I am taking Johnny Miller's advice and not really considering Argentina, Brazil, or Chile anymore. However, I would like to hear about her thought process in choosing which country to go to. Ecuador sounds wonderful from her description. Thanks to both of you. Chris, New Haven, Connecticut." Okay, well, I had a number of people, as a matter of fact, asking to communicate with Sarita about her recent relocation from New York City to Cuenca in Ecuador. She emailed me yesterday, no less, saying that she would be happy to talk to anyone and share her experiences. So if you'd like to correspond with her, please email me and I'll pass along her email address. And by the way, in her email to me, she added the following, and I quote, "Here, the fact that the cell phones and electronic apparatuses aren't much used makes people nice to be around. While in Salinas, we loved seeing the whales. But what I really most enjoyed was seeing everyone in groups at the beach just talking and laughing. People were walking around, sitting around, playing volleyball, and just having the best time. I haven't been at a beach where every few yards another group of people was laughing at something that was being said and everyone had a smile on their face. Many vendors of all types sold ice cream and ice coconuts. Others were selling jewelry they make. Still others were there with their newest style as well as the old style, as one fellow said, of sunglasses. Though they wanted to sell, they were not at all obnoxious. The entire experience was a real treat. Regards, Sarita." Oh, and in regards to a listener's complaint about the altitude problem in Ecuador, she wrote, "We did hear Gary's story of the altitude, and I'm sorry he didn't stay a bit longer. There are remedies for this, mainly the cocoa tea and some medication to prevent inflammation of the brain, which can be deadly, and in time the lungs do adjust. However, I do understand why he left. Not getting oxygen is a most scary situation. It is strange that one is affected at night and woken up, not being able to get enough air to breathe." That was Erika. All right. Well, hopefully that answers in part your question, Chris, as to why she chose Ecuador. I don't know why she chose them over Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia. And Tarita, if you would like to enlarge on that in a quick email, I am sure Chris would be interested. Otherwise, if you would let me, if you would like me to give him your email address, I will do so, and he can correspond with you directly. Well, as was evident to those who received my email chart the other day, outstanding credit, mostly from credit cards, is approaching record levels again. This means that it is likely that consumers are getting pretty close to maxing out on their credit cards and other lines of credit. It also means that this prior recovery over the past 2 years was fueled by illegitimate means, meaning the growth was fueled by consumers who used money they did not have. There are many, many factors which can be looked at to help determine if the economy is about to seize up again, as it did during the financial crisis, but consumer credit ought to be watched by more people. The focus is usually on non-farm payrolls or GDP, but consumer credit is a leading indicator rather than a trailing indicator, in that it allows one to see how leveraged the economy is getting. The more credit outstanding at the time the economy stops functioning, the harder asset prices will fall. This data leads to a rather simple conclusion. If consumers finally reach a point where they have reached their borrowing limits and there is no job growth to save them, it is likely that those consumers will no longer be able to buy anything. And because consumption makes up two-thirds of GDP, all of the pieces are in place for a recession. My personal observations lead me to believe that consumer credit will climb significantly all summer, which could make the economy as weak as ever going into the coming election season. So there you are, ladies and gentlemen, consumer credit. Watch it. That's what's going to give you the lowdown into what really is going to happen. So, let's see how we're doing for time in all this. We have 5 beautiful minutes left. Let's take another email. This one is from, I don't know who it is from, actually. It comes down in the middle of the email. Anyway, let me read the email to you, and maybe we'll find out. Oh, it's from Mike. It's from Mike. Okay, Mike, here we go. "Richard, I really tried to read most of what you send us folks on your mailing list, and everything I read is very informative, although I don't always understand all the charts. But that's not my question. After reading the article you sent located at the very bottom of the page from Leap 2020, I went to Leap's homepage to see more, since I found the article very informative. I like these crisis weather forecasts. Well, I don't like them, but you know what I mean. On their site, I found an article which was linked to a book regarding the upcoming real estate collapse. I was wondering if you read it yet. I'm presuming not, because it's a pretty long read at 188 pages, and your concentration is on the financial markets, although I know you touch on housing and how it will come down as well. The last sentence of the article advertising the book says the following, and I quote, 'The analyses and recommendations given in this book will help the various players in the housing market, households, investors, and politicians,' end of quote. Since I am both a small investor five houses to 12 units total, and a household homeowner, a camp in the Adirondacks of New York State, a main home near the capital of New York State, and a condo in Costa Rica, do you think purchasing the book would be worthy of my investment, or do you think selling everything in general is the best course? Sometimes I think I should hold on to them, other times I think I should dump some investment props to pay off the others and own only two or three free and clear, as opposed to five with various amounts of mortgages. I know, move out of the U.S. I have an exit plan, sort of, but my wife and I won't leave our families yet. Anyway, I'm very confused, as I'm sure most people are. I'm even kind of frightened, but trying to maintain a positive outlook on mine and my family's future. If you read the book, I'd love to know if you think I should have a look as well. Thanks, Mike. No rush on a response. It's not coming tomorrow, but I still think I may have time to unload if needed. Or maybe the book provides insight. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the book I do not have open with me. Again, I didn't have time to prepare this, and I apologize. But if you go to Google Leap 2020 and read the current comment of the Leap people, I'm sure you will find that book advertised on the right. In answer to your question, Mike, I haven't read the book, so I can't obviously recommend it. However, what I can recommend and do recommend heartily, sell as much real estate as at least pays off all your debts. You really have no business paying off debts with losing real estate. Sell off the real estate, at least if you don't want to sell it all, which I suggest you do, sell off all the real estate and live free and clear with what remains. And this should be, you know, investment real estate 101, Mike. I really feel very, very strongly about that, and I'm glad to be able to bring that to the attention of the listeners, because they also should know that you should sell down all your assets, at the very least, to liquidate all your debts. So please do that, Mike. The quicker you do that, the more money, frankly, I will consider I have saved you by encouraging to do this. So this is something that you will want to do, quite frankly, without delay. Which ones to sell, I don't really know. I'm not going to make a determination. As a rule of thumb, I would tend to sell the ones which are losing the most, because that will hopefully give you more of a tax deduction over time. But the decision, of course, has to remain yours. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have come to the end. It is again 11 a.m. your time, Eastern time, and 11 p.m. my time. So with that, I am going to bid you a wonderful weekend, and I will be back with you again on Monday. This is Richard saying bye-bye till then.